And our guest, Joe Nickel, we're going to take calls as we talk about the science of ghosts when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Joe, I want you to finish up on that McKenzie House story that you investigated.
Or the spontaneous combustion, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I pretty much finished on McKenzie House.
Did you?
But it didn't explain the spontaneous human combustion.
Okay. Which is a great field. I've done several shows on that, and
it's fascinating.
It's baffling.
I'll try to clear it up. I need to give out that 800 number if I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
1-800-634-1610. And we'll send a free magazine.
All right.
Tell them Joe sent me or something.
Why don't you give that one more time to people who haven't had a chance to write that down.
1-800-634-1610.
Okay. Now, back to spontaneous combustion.
Yes, spontaneous combustion, of course, is a fact, but spontaneous human combustion is an old wives' tale. It's a sort of non-explanation for cases like I described, people badly burned, no apparent source of the ignition. But modern science has finally begun to have an idea. Let me give a very briefly a typical case. Mary Reeser, St. Petersburg, Florida, 1951, I believe. And Mrs. Reeser was last seen, healthy and alive and sitting in a stuffed chair. And some hours later, workmen were alerted, broke in, and they couldn't find Mrs. Reeser. And there in the center of the apartment was a chair burned up. And finally, investigators found bits and pieces of her body and a greasy stain. And it's very mysterious, but when we add some facts to the case, when Mrs. Reeser was last seen, she was smoking a cigarette. She had taken 2-Secanol sleeping tablets. Most people can see that she was an accident waiting to happen. How did she catch on fire? From smoking. Why did the body burn so thoroughly? Well, she was a obese woman, and even a lean person has a considerable amount of fat in their body, midriff, thighs. And anyone who's ever caught some bacon grease on fire in a stove knows what a violent amount of flame can result. Once and here's the secret to the cases, I think, most cases that involve this, the body is not burning at very much at first, and then but it's melting body fat, and that body fat is being absorbed by clothing or chair stuffing or carpeting. In what we now know, and this is science has been advancing this, the wick effect. And the body is burning now efficiently in the same way a candle burns efficiently by a wick. Otherwise, it doesn't burn efficiently.
That's right.
Efficiently. And so what's happening is the body fat melts and it gasifies and burns and melts more fat, which is absorbed, and it's a sort of cyclic effect. And this is happening over a long period of time, and there's never a big fire, just this small, steady, persistent, and very, very thorough fire in which the body's providing fuel for its own destruction, and it's burning over and over and over and over. And we now have just a lot of evidence that that's what happened, and in our 30 cases, we were able to go back and show, you know, knocked over oil lamps, bodies lying on the hearth. And the people trying to promote these mysteries would say, oh, well, here's a case where they were lying on the hearth, all right, but there was no fire in the hearth. And I mean, they're just insisting on creating mystery. But, you know, you could be starting to light a fire. And in the old days of sputtering matches, a spark could get on your clothing and smolder and burst into flame later. But it's interesting that over and over there's a profile that applies to most cases. These people are alone. Otherwise, they're rescued, you see. They're alone.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually elderly or incapacitated in some way, such as being intoxicated or whatever.
Or confined to a wheelchair.
Yes, exactly. Lots of cases. Dr. Bentley had a walker and was 92 years old. So, in other words, a person is not able to respond well to an emergency. And then we have evidence at the scene time and again of the laws of physics are alive and well. They are working. But there's this, when you put in the wick effect, John DeHaan, one of the nation's top fire experts, built on our work and actually used a carcass of a pig, dressed it up, and the wick effect is a reality.
It does work. Now, are you saying back to the ghosts that there is no life after death, that there are no ghosts, or are you saying you just don't know?
Well, I think we have to look at the hard facts. You know, you need your brain. I need my brain when we think, walk, do anything. The idea that we don't really need our brains, it's just sort of an incidental thing, we might use it, might not, is ludicrous. So when you die, and I'm talking about now not marginal cases where somebody might be revived, I'm talking about really dead, brain decomposed, then that's the destruction of the brain, and there's going to be no brain activity. So the idea, and this is a popular idea in the most ancient folklore, and it's alive and well today on cheap cable TV channels, and the public believes it in huge numbers, that somehow none of that matters. You just, your spirit just gets right up out of your body and can walk around and think and haunt a place and say boo and do all that, leave heavy thudding footsteps and so forth. This is not a scientific idea, because once the brain is dead, brain activity ceases. Any energy, you hear the New Agers all use the term energy as if it's an explanation for something, but they're not using energy the way scientists use energy. They're talking about a mystical, magical force when they use the word energy. So they're of a mind that somehow your energy leaves your body, stays together, doesn't have a brain but doesn't need one, and goes off and becomes a ghost. This is really pretty silly stuff. And the idea then that this energy could stay together is to say it's problematic is a great understatement. In other words, when you turn off a light, just turn off a lamp, the light is not going to the mysterious light bulb realm. It's ceasing to exist as light. And the energy that's come off is going to quickly dissipate. It isn't going to stay together. So we're not going to be able to go in a week later or, for heaven's sake, 100 years later and with a psychic find the light bulb hovering there. That's not going to happen. But it's a similar analogy. People just believe this. And why do they believe it? Well, they want to believe it passionately, and then they have lots and lots and lots of stories of people waking up and seeing ghosts and things happening. I know that I didn't put those keys down there. The ghost moved them. But I know I mislay my keys.
Let me ask you this. It's off the subject for a moment, but it does make this all a little more concrete. Physicists are now saying that they believe in the multiverse theory, and that's growing. That's growing in physics, where there's more than one universe, which I find unbelievable to understand. But they're beginning to say now that there are multi-universes. They're all attached like bubbles.
And I think there's something to that. I mean, therefore, our universe didn't come out of nothing. I suspect that nothingness cannot exist.
Well, I agree with that. And, I can't even understand the concept of nothingness.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are only two possibilities: nothingness or something. And I think we got something, and it's constantly evolved and changed. And I understand that concept, but it. You know, before we bring that in very far to studies of the paranormal, we need to first see if we need that. In other words, we don't say, okay, just forget the common sense stuff, put the footsteps on the stairs at McKenzie House aside, forget this, forget that, forget, don't talk about waking dreams, and let's bring in, you know, some hypothetical aspect of multiple universes or alternate universes or something. I think that those are not applicable to most of the paranormal cases that I come across.
Would you call remote viewing paranormal?
Yes, it's a paranormal claim. And I'm not aware. I've met people who claim to do remote viewing and I'm a magician. I've done remote viewing. I know magicians who can do it as a trick. But there's no credible scientific evidence that anyone has the power of remote viewing under carefully controlled scientific conditions.
Well, the government had a remote viewing program.
They did, and one of my colleagues, Ray Hyman, was asked to assess it. He and a Miss Utz were a sort of a skeptic and believer, or more or less, but both open-minded and fair-minded, and they studied the program. But Ray Hyman's report showed, and it's published in our magazine, showed that there really was no evidence, did not meet the standards of, I mean, there were all kinds of fortune tellers and tarot card readers and stuff in the program. And what's happening with a lot of the remote viewing is that, you know, if you say a number of things, I may be able later to match them up. I mean, this is the trick that the psychic detectives are basically using, you know, the so-called psychics like Dorothy Allison, late Dorothy Allison, and others, you know, who would claim that, oh, they solved cases for police. And when you talk to the police, you say, wow, these clairvoyants are helping you so well. Well, sort of, they say. And you say, well,
they don't want to admit it, though.
They told you exactly where the body was. Well, not exactly. Well, they drew on a map exactly and pinpointed it with GPS where the, well, not exactly. And you say, well, okay, detective, what exactly did they do? And you hear this over and over. It's almost laughable. They'll say, well, we didn't understand the psychic's clues when she first told them to us. I said, well, what were those clues? Well, I see the number 7. I see water. I see a tall structure, and so forth. And the detectives scratch their head, and they say, this doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't help them at all. But once they've solved the case, not the psychic, but they found with a tracking dog or a tip or a lucky stumbling upon of a hunter, they solve the case, they find the body. The psychic comes in and says, aha, remember I said there was water, and sure enough, the body was not far from a creek or a stream or a river or
but
a
why,
pond.
But why can't you
lake.
Say maybe they were right?
Well, but if we apply the rule of Occam's razor, and we've got two hypotheses, one that that an assassin fired a bullet, and another that the alien spaceship came and caused the bullet to dissolve and do all kinds of amazing things, and then kill somebody, we choose the simpler one. So if I can explain by retrofitting, and if all a psychic has done is come in and say, well, the number 7 was approximately 7 miles out of town or whatever, and people fall for that. Seasoned detectives fall for it, but it's a trick. And even in one case that I remember, I did a book called Psychic Sleuths, which I was editor of. We had a case with Greta Alexander, the psychic, and the police were so convinced that she had to be accurate that when there wasn't a church, she had mentioned a church, and there wasn't a church anywhere near the dead body. They just had to have that, you see, because they were doing her work for her. They were retrofitting. They were fitting her vague statements, picking and choosing and fitting them to the situation. So they finally found that there was some nearby property owned by a church, and they counted that. What's called confirmation bias, where you start with the answer that you want, and then you just look for evidence to confirm it. And everybody does that all over the place.
Well, it's the old saying, shoot the arrow, and whatever it hits, that's the target.
Yeah, then draw a bullseye around it.
That's right.
Well, but people do that, and you know, to some extent, debunkers do it, and I criticize them when they do. But I think that the remote viewing, we could settle the matter. We have a remote viewer. We set up a test, but it would be a strictly engineered test. No trickery would be allowed, no retrofitting, no nothing. And I predict they'll fail, and I think that's the track record so far. I might just mention that I was in Hungary less than 2 years ago, and visited a parapsychological laboratory there where they were doing tests in remote viewing. They were doing Ganzfeld experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And, to sort of have some fun, I became a subject for one run. And I hit the target.
Well, maybe you're a good remote viewer.
Yeah, we all had fun with that one because I went around, you know, doing a victory lap all over the place, and they were just laughing and laughing.
What about faith, though, Joe? Where does faith come into some of this? Or you might not have definitive proof, but you know that.
No, in quotation marks?
Yeah, in quotation marks. You know that, you know, something gave you that telepathy that told you don't go through that intersection. And you know what? My God, you got saved because you didn't do that. What about something like that?
Well, faith is, you know, you could have faith in anything. You could have faith in a government or a con man. You could have faith in anything. And this is a choice. I choose to live an evidence-based life. I choose to do that. I know some people don't choose to do it, but I prefer, there's a place for emotions in our life. I'm for example, a serious poet. I play the guitar. I'm an artist. But I don't use my feelings to decide basic matters of health care and so forth. And so I think it's a choice. I choose to look for evidence and not to just believe in something because I would like to. Or because, and then it starts getting fuzzy quick, of course, people say, yes, well, I didn't believe in ghosts either, but then I saw a ghost.
Hold on, Joe. Well, we're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take some phone calls next with you. A lot of folks have been on hold. The Science of Ghosts, you're next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're going to turn you loose next. You've been on hold long enough. Your phone calls with Joe Nickel, author of The Science of Ghosts, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Joe, before we grab these calls, give out your toll-free number again, would you? And that, again, is for what, a free newsletter magazine?
A free copy of Skeptical Inquirer Science Magazine.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
1-800-634-1610.
Great.
And our website is csicop.org. We used to be known as PsyCop, but we've shortened it to CSI. Took too long to say our other name, and we've broadened our scope. So, Committee for Skeptical Inquiry.
All right, super. To the phones now we go. We go to East Liverpool in Ohio. Sean is with us, first-time caller. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Sean, or George, how you guys doing tonight?
Good,
happy
Sean.
4th of July.
You too.
Thank you.
First off, being a former investigator, I have to say firsthand that I know the activity is authentic. It's out there. For example, I've captured EVP and I've gotten intelligent responses. To me, it's not a question of is it real, it's a question of what is it. And my research has led me to believe that this is demonic in nature. I mean, in the Bible it states that the dead know nothing at all and that they can no longer partake in anything that is done under the sun. So to me, that would be demonic. But I guess to you, Joe, I know you really haven't exercised the equipment, the general paranormal activity equipment that ghost hunters use. But my question to you is...
Well, I have examined them. I have talked to experts.
Have you captured an EVP, though, an intelligent response?
I know quite a bit about EVP, and the least likely explanation for EVP is that ghosts are doing it. You know, to say that ghosts are responsible for electronic voice phenomena,
I think they're ghosts.
It's like saying it's an X factor. It's a non-explanation. In other words, you don't know what's causing it. And a lot of this, the EVP is just some glitches caused by, you know, something acoustic experts and others could help you with. But the least likely explanation, again, is that it's ghosts saying get out. And no evidence that demons exist, and certainly not EVP. I mean, you should know that no scientific journals have validated this. There's no evidence whatsoever of any scientific nature. So what you're doing, and with all due respect, you're just stating a belief that you have, that you've gotten some results and you've interpreted them and you think you can hear some words, but there are people who can see, you know, holy images of Jesus in a tortilla, and that doesn't mean that's a miracle.
Is it possible, Joe? Perception. Is it possible that these events, these paranormal events, just can't be proven?
Well, it may be, but then that's very, very unfortunate, because how do we separate the real ghost from all the, you know, 99% fake ghosts? And again, it's not for me to prove it isn't so. Someone has to prove it. I can't emphasize this enough, that just because we don't have proof of leprechauns doesn't mean that leprechauns don't exist, but the average person treats it as if it doesn't exist because there's no evidence. And there's not a great political lobby for leprechauns, but a lot of very similar invisible entities that only special people, clairvoyants and others can see, ghosts and demons, these get a lot of attraction because they promise something. Mm-hmm. They appeal to our hopes and fears, and people are concerned about it. But there's no better evidence for a demonic spirit than there is for a leprechaun.
There was
a
guy,
century, and there was a lot of people who'd seen leprechauns and had encounters with them. They kind of trailed off.
There was a guy in Seattle a few weeks ago who claims he got beaten up in a bar by a group of leprechauns.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And as a matter of fact, the police even went back to check it out, and apparently they couldn't find the leprechauns. But
an Irish bar, no doubt.
It might have been. You don't know.
These are my people, George, and I'm Irish, and, you know, maybe we shouldn't pursue this too much further.
But you know what, Beck, you brought up leprechauns. I think something's happening. I don't know what it is, but I think people are seeing something.
Yes, people do have real experiences. You know, people do see, or they have an experience in which they perceive seeing a ghost at the bedside, for example. And that is a real experience, but it isn't a real ghost. And then some people see a ghost without being in bed at all and without having a waking dream. But those people, the typical apparitional experience is very brief. It's usually when the person is tired or nearer the sleep state or in some altered state of consciousness, such as daydreaming. They're not doing something that's has them very, very mentally alert. And there's a great deal of data now that's been gone over with apparitional experiences. And one other thing that's worth just touching on here, at least, is the fantasy-prone personality. About 4% of the American public is fantasy-prone. That is, they're a perfectly sane and normal person, but they have tendencies to fantasize, and they imagine that they're clairvoyant. And the people that talk to the Virgin Mary, who have communications with the space beings and who are abducted by aliens, people who have a household ghost sometimes, if they communicate with the ghost, these people are special, and they're very colorful, and I know many of them. But they're at one end of the imaginative spectrum, and they would make better poets and artists than they would alien abductees if they knew what was going on.
We go to Pat now in Warren, Michigan. Hey, Pat, thanks for calling.
Hi, Joe. I've been dealing with a painful medical health condition for about 16 years. And one time I really scared my mother. In the middle of the night, I'm sleeping, and I'm talking to her in some kind of unknown language. And another time I get smacked in the face in the middle of the night where my head snaps back. And I'm just wondering if you can comment on that. Could it be a curse?
Well, that would be at the bottom of my list, because we would have to.
They're all at the bottom of your list, Joseph.
If it's paranormal, we have to go through the normal world first. That's what science does. We don't just say, well, could be a curse, or could be some psychological thing related to being not fully awake and so forth. I mean, the unknown language is interesting, of course, because we have religious people who speak in tongues. I know a lady who claims to, who sounds like she's speaking in tongues, but she's actually channeling, she says, the space aliens from distant galaxies. We worked together on Anderson Cooper's daytime show. Fantasy prone, I'm sure. But the caller, has had some real experience, and he could explore this with a psychologist or somebody. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's had a real experience. But there's just no evidence that he's cursed. This idea that demons are affecting us is really a superstition of a bygone era, and we ought to be trying to stamp it out here in the 21st century.
I assume you do not believe in heaven and hell, Joseph.
That's right. I don't believe, but remember, science isn't in the belief business.
No,
doesn't
I
much
know.
Matter what I think. Is there evidence for either heaven or hell? And I think these are, you know, some people perceive heaven in an altered mental state. You can do it with certain varieties of mushrooms and other experiences, but you're playing with your mind, and you're not really experiencing actual heaven. The near-death experience is fascinating, but people who are not Christians rarely see Jesus. They see whatever their culture proposes. And we know that the similarity of near-death experiences around the world is because the brain is similar. For example, the idea of the tunnel, you're going through a tunnel. This is in my book, The Science of Ghosts, is just an effect of the visual cortex. And people are having a type of hallucination, either from the drugs that they've been administered for surgery, or because of oxygen deprivation or what have you. And it's been studied quite a lot. Been articles, learned articles in our magazine. Near-death experiences are experiences that people have. They're fascinating. I don't laugh at them, but they're not actual flights to heaven.
So what you're saying, when someone dies, folks, it's lights out, that's it. It's all over.
That's right. And it's the same with their pet poodle. The life ceases. And, you know, we can choose to come to terms with that, live good lives, and try to leave a legacy. And for many of us, immortality comes in our life work and our children and grandchildren and so forth. But I know that it gives some people comfort to feel that they don't really die, and they'll have the John Edwards and others. I'm talking about the psychic John Edwards.
I've had him on.
Yes.
I've had him on.
And I caught him cheating on a Dateline NBC show. We caught him cheating on Dateline NBC.
What did he do?
Well, he was, I told the Dateline people, I said, don't have John Edwards mill about with your subjects, because he can pick up cues and bits of gossip and stuff and use it later. And I said, he doesn't have to, because he's very good at cold reading. He can just start off talking and say things, and you'll retrofit, you'll just match it up. And the things that don't fit, you'll forget. And he just says a lot of things, and you'll match it up because you believe. And so they kept him away and from the audience. And then so the show is being recorded, and he starts talking about a person who's dead and his name is Anthony, and he's getting fairly specific. There's a coffin, and there's something to do with the putting a ring on or taking it off his finger and so forth. Very specific, and nobody in the audience is relating to this. He's not saying you picking someone out and matching them up. He's throwing this out. But all of a sudden, one of the Dateline cameramen is overcome with emotion, and of course, this story fit his father, Anthony, at his funeral. But it turns out, George, that Dateline had not kept John Edward from the camera persons. They had been with him all day doing B-roll shots.
And maybe he heard it or
something. Oh, he absolutely, the guy did eventually remember that he had, oh, yeah, I guess I told him that. But so when John Hockenberry had him on, you know, he tried to duck and dodge and weave, and Hockenberry kept saying, but no, wait a minute, he would say, you know, you knew that going in, didn't you? And you just pretended to us that you just got that information from the other side, but in fact you knew it, and so forth. It was a real pleasure to watch John Edwards squirm and so forth. If you read his book, Crossing Over, and I don't I don't recommend that you go pay money for it, but if you do, turn over near the back and you'll see that me, Joe Nickel, John Hockenberry, Dateline, and our organization are all criticized by him for our gotcha moment, as he calls.
Would you ever debate some of these folks on this show?
Oh, I have debated people from Uri Geller to James Van Praagh, but they don't like to debate me. They don't want to come on with me, and it doesn't usually end up getting very far because we're just on different wavelengths. I mean,
I don't want it to be a shouting session. You know, nothing gets done that way.
Pardon?
I don't want it to be a shouting session.
Well, that's what often happens. I've had them actually where radio shows have had us both on or something, and they didn't know I was going to come on, and I asked a few pointed questions, and they were out of there. So, Uri Geller, who claims to bend the metal with his brain waves, and
I got to tell you,
he's doing it the hard way.
He's done some strange things on this show. He had based on people who wrote into me, he started clocks up and stuff like that. Was weird. Well, there are weird times.
Well, mentalists do this, and the difference between, you know, the difference between a mentalist and a psychic, well, $200 is one difference, but the mentalist is a magician doing this for entertainment, and the psychic is, I guess, doing it for money.
Well, I booted a psychic off our show because I thought it was a blatant falsehood. No need for me to give the name again. But,
yeah, well, good for you. Good for you. I wish I knew who it was so I could revile them in private. But maybe
you may have already done that. But you know, I've seen some psychics, Joe, at events that say, "Did you have a dead brother? No. Did you have a dead sister? No. Did you have a dead uncle? Yes." And they go, "Oh yes, I'm seeing him." And so they know someone. I'm not talking about all of them, because there are some people who are pretty intuitive, I think. And that's
where they may be picking up things, you know, body language and cues and so forth. And they not necessarily doing it, you know, fraudulently. They may be just doing it instinctively and may indeed tend to. You know, we often give ourselves away when someone's fishing for information. There, we knit our brows or we look surprised, and we're not aware we're doing that.
I taught a
young lady once, an actress for a TV documentary, and taught her to do some psychic stuff. And we were on the near the Santa Monica Pier, and she used the question trick. So she used it on this one guy, this passerby. You know, she would stop people and do a reading.
Yeah.
And so I taught her, just say, you know, do you have a sister, for example? And if the person says yes, you just look like, see, I just told you that. You just give them that look. But if they say no, they don't have a sister, you never back down. You say, oh, but there's someone who's like a sister to you when you were growing up, and you get out of it. And so there's this guy, they polled these people later and said, how good was she? And the guy said, oh, she's very good. They said, well, give us an example of what you think she did that was really, really, you know, really impressive. And he said, well, for example, she told me I had a sister. So I would just, you know, it was funny because we just, you know, it was just a little trick. And, but.
Or cover your bases, go up to a woman who's pregnant and say, you're going to have a boy or maybe a girl.
Well, people will, in readings, they will, after the person fishes for a while and so forth, they will begin to talk. Now, if the psychic gets a skeptic and the skeptic says, well, you tell me and so forth, they just give them a stock reading and dust them off and collect their $50. But if the psychic is, if the sitter is credulous and a believer, pretty soon they're saying, yes, that's true. My sister did this and that and so forth. And not realizing they've just provided a whole lot of information that the psychic will wait and not feed it back yet, but wait about 10 minutes and then maybe not feed it in the same words, but make maybe an extrapolation from it because they've got some new information. And it's a real art. The gypsies made a real art of this method of reading, and they could fool skeptics.
All right, Joe, hold on. We've got a lot of people still on hold for you, and I want to get those calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And he's giving out a free copy of the Skeptical Inquirer magazine. If you call 1-800-634-1610. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment, we'll have more calls with him. I may do open lines the last 30 minutes of the show because I've got still some Independence Day events I want to be able to play for you, too. We'll be back.